Politics.
Raum für
Wechselseitiges. Ein Podcast mit
Dorothea Kurtoy
und Astrid Habiber-Kressmeier.
Herzlich willkommen bei Sympoietics. Nach längerer Zeit lassen wir wieder einmal von uns hören, aber dafür gibt es gleich auch eine Premiere. Zum ersten Mal haben wir ein Gespräch live bei einer Veranstaltung mit Publikum aufgenommen. Habiber hat im November gemeinsam mit ihrem Team des Sympo-Institutes zu einem Symposium ins Appenzellerland eingeladen. Träume und Trickster war der Titel. Einer der Gäste, Dr. Bayo Akomolafe. Das Gespräch mit ihm könnt ihr hier in englischer Sprache hören. Und dazu gleich ein kleines Sorry, our English isn't the best. Und noch ein Hinweis zum besseren Verständnis. Habiber wird gleich zu Beginn Eshu ins Spiel bringen. Eshu ist eine Kraft aus der Mythologie der afrikanischen Yoruba-Tradition, die im Zuge des transatlantischen Sklavenhandels auch in die Amerikas und andere Teile der Welt gereist ist. Eshu hat viele Qualitäten. Bayo wird davon erzählen. Was Eshu als Trickster besonders liebt, ist der Anfang. Deshalb geht's jetzt los. Viel Freude beim Hören.
At the beginning of our conversation, it's my pleasure to briefly introduce you. You were born in 1983 in southwestern Nigeria into a Christian home, father and mother from Yoruba people. Your father was a diplomat and the family emigrated to Bonn, the former capital of Germany, when you were a little boy. How long did you stay there?
I think we were there for about 3-4 years. Yeah, I was a little boy when we left Germany, so we're there for about 3 years.
At the age of 15, you lost your father. He died because of a sudden heart complication. And you say this was a very painful loss for you and brought big trouble and deep change for the family. But you also say these experiences of life and death were the beginning of your journey as an intellectual. You studied psychology, made your master and PhD in Covenant University, a Christian university in Ota, Ogun State in Nigeria, and then started a new chapter of your journey, a next new chapter, a deep dive into a completely different way of thinking, the wisdom of the more than human world. You met 6 Yoruba healers, and what happened there will be part of our conversation. For now, let's jump to the present. You are a worldwide known public intellectual. You are a speaker, author, a teacher. And what's very important for you, we have seen your son, is your family, your 2 children. And your life partner, your wife. And with your family, you live in the US and in India. And as far as I know, you are in India at the moment.
I am in India, in a retreat center somewhere in Chennai with larger family, hence my blurred background. It's not my home or my office, but I'm here in Chennai, India.
So Bayo, it's a great pleasure for us to be connected with you tonight, and a warm welcome to you.
Likewise, thank you so much for inviting me. Thank you.
So to jump in this kind of African roots or Nigerian roots or Yoruba roots, I wanted to ask you to tell a little bit about your relationship with Eshu.
While I was growing up, there was this story that Eshu is the devil. I don't know if you're hearing that, yeah. Right? The name for devil in my language, Yoruba, is Eshu. And this came about through colonization. So when the British the Anglican Church became part of the colonial edifice in present-day Nigeria, the land now called Nigeria. They needed to translate English into the Yoruba Bible. And this was effected not by a British missionary, but by a Yoruba person who became the first Anglican bishop, the first Black Yoruba Anglican bishop in the world. And his name was Samuel Ajayi Crowther. And he took the English Bible and translated it into the Yoruba tongue. Now, he had a problem while he was translating because the Yoruba tradition does not have any space for villains and bad guys, right? There's no evil person in our spirituality, in our cosmology. We just have politics. We just have political, very political orishas. Orishas are our gods, right? But he needed a bad guy, an essentially evil guy. And so he took the trickster. The trickster is Eshu, right? Because of his ambiguity and because of his seductive promiscuity, he took Eshu and made him the devil. And so I grew up, this is context, right? I grew up thinking that Eshu is the devil. I had no other premise. I had no other proposition. Eshu is the devil. It was after my father died that I started to really explore the decolonial, or rather the colonial histories of my culture, and how our tongue, our habits of mind, our imaginations, our hopes for the future were shaped by this event, right? And then I started to really revisit the idea that Eshu is the devil. And shock of all shocks, to my surprise, Eshu is not the devil. There's actually a movement, not just in Brazil, but in Nigeria today, called Eshu is not the devil. It's really, really powerful. My own thoughts about it is that Eshu wouldn't mind. He has no qualms with being named anything. If you call him the devil, he'll be like, okay, let's explore what that might mean, right? He doesn't have any qualms with taking on new identities, right? But my most profound, and I started to engage with Eshu as a trickster, but not just as any trickster, but as a seminal figure in the Anthropocene, a seminal figure, a powerful figure in the politics of fascism, in the politics of climate chaos, in the issues of genocide, all the things that we contend with today, I feel, even racialization and the transatlantic slave trade, issue seems to play a don't let me say central role, because tricksters are never central. Tricksters thrive at the edges of things, not in the middle. They don't thrive in the middle. They lurk in the penumbra of things. They lurk in the shadows of things. And so Eshu seems to feature in the most monumental stories that shape modernity. The case in point, and I'll end here. Case in point is the story of the transatlantic slave trade. The story that my elders teach me is that when the slave ships came to Africa, when they came to Africa, all the orishas, and I don't know if you know some of them, you might know some of them, Ogun, Oya, Osun, Iemanja, all of them, right? The
All very
Avengers,
powerful, yeah.
all very powerful. They're the Avengers of the Yoruba cosmology, and they mounted up an insurgency. They said, we're going to stop the slave trade from happening because the ships came to our lands, right? And so this started to happen, and Eshu came and he deceived his siblings, the other Orishas. He deceived them with a deceptive military strategy and ultimately put them all to sleep by dosing their drinks with an intoxicating brew or palm wine. Okay? So they all went to sleep, and then he proceeded to sneak aboard the slave ships. That is, he, in the dead of night, he snuck onto the slave ships and he traveled with the slaves. I'd always questioned this story at first, but then this story taught me that victory is just as much a risk as failure. issue is my most powerful teacher.
So, would you agree if I say Ishu is a post-activist?
Yes, I don't think he would mind at all, right?
Yeah.
Well, because post-activism is the ethical breach of moral architectures. It is noticing that when goodness doesn't seem good enough, when goodness just seems to collapse back into the same economy of relations and the same colonial logics that we're trying to leave behind, then you need a break. You need a crack. Agency and accountability in ways that are yet to come.
And it's interesting, all the others left and Eshu joined the slaves. It's a kind of care.
Yes.
It's interesting. So he really was together with them, and probably he also kept a kind of crack, yeah. In that crack also could come in a new future
Yes.
for them. Or how do you describe this special kind of care?
I'm very delighted to hear you say that Eshu's accompaniment of the slaves was a form of care. It really was a form of care because, and this is what I say about care, and I'm teaching about care in a new course with Gabor Mate on Tuesday. I'm starting a course about care, right? When a warm embrace slowly becomes a chokehold, right? That is, we can be harmed by our care. We can be harmed by our forms of care. What do you do when hope becomes a form of violence? What happens when care becomes poison or when medicine becomes sick? And I'm not the first to ask these kind of questions. Deleuze, Guattari, Jean-Henri. These were French philosophers. French philosophers, I like French philosophers for a reason, and German philosophers as well, but especially these these continental philosophers inspire me. And they've been asking these questions for a long time. What happens when medicine becomes sick? The thing to do is I'm not going to discuss the thing to do now because that's a lengthy consideration. But I think Eshu became the archetype of what I call cura poesis. And cura poesis is the becoming of care, the making of care. It's not care yet, but it is how care emerges from coloniality. It's a different form of care. It's when a soul sprouts new limbs and becomes different, right? So I think that's what Eshu practiced. He didn't, to the other orishas, he was a treacherous, duplicitous, conniving fugitive. They did not like this act. And when I first heard this story, I did not like it myself. I wanted defeat. I wanted clear victory. But he understood at some level that if we beat them at their own game, we've lost. If we beat them at their own game, we've lost. And so he decided to travel with them. And because he traveled with them, he co-created samba, capoeira, candomblé, umbanda, Rastafaria. All these spiritual traditions came from his decision to accompany the slaves instead of staying behind and fighting it. And this speaks to popular forms of resistance today, that the way we resist fascism could become a form of fascism. The way that the left and the right are stuck in a politics of sides could actually reiterate the violence that we're trying to leave behind. And so we need the crack, an issue exploited to crack.
You offer a lot of ideas also to understand the principles of our, let's say, Western psychology. And I heard you tell that the characterism of our psychology is that she wants to fix the things. She wants to fix the individual. She wants to fix the psyche. But they are not fixed. The world is not fixed. It's moving. It's like the shoe trickster. He is the moving. He is not to be fixed as a devil. So maybe you can talk a bit about these differences, about these, what's about the idea of getting fixed, and what the ways we are not refixing, but we are really opening.
Right. So I was a practicing psychotherapist, clinical psychologist. My primary training is in clinical psychology. My doctorate is in clinical psychology. And I was trained according to the Austrian paradigms. I'm referring to Sigmund Freud and the architecture of the couch, the architecture of the couch, right? I was trained to think about the individual as the primary object of therapeutic concern. Okay, but I have a story to tell, and some of you might know the story because I'm not just a Yoruba cosmology nerd. I am just as much a, I mean, not just as much, but to some certain degree, I am a Greek mythology nerd. And so there is this dear dude, this brother called Procrustes. I don't know if anyone in the room knows Procrustes. If you know Procrustes, just raise your hand in the air and wave them like you just don't care. Anyone? No? No?
Oh,
No?
that's
Oh,
one.
they're in the back. They're in the back. That one person knows Procrustes. Excellent, excellent. Procrustes was a highway robber. He was a thief. And he had his band of merry men. Well, I'm just kidding. They were not merry. They were not like Robin Hood or anything like that. But Procrustes stole from people, and he did something even much worse. I'm wondering why Hollywood, or I don't know what the movie industry in Europe or in Germany, would call their industry. But I wonder, I've not watched the movie about Procrustes yet. It'll make for some fascinating horror. You see, what happens if you're traveling from here to there, on the road, you're going somewhere, Procrustes, and if you encounter Procrustes, he would invite you into his house. Like a spontaneous Airbnb, okay? And he would give you his bed to sleep. And maybe he would give you some tea or beer or something like that, to go to bed. And then in the dead of night, in the middle of the night, Procrustes would come and measure you, okay? Measure you in relation to the bed, okay? While you are sound asleep. He would measure you in relation to the bed. Now, I don't know you, my sisters, I don't know how tall you are, but if you're taller than the bed, he would cut you down to size. So the part of your body that extends beyond the bed, okay? The part of your body that extends beyond the bed, he'll shave it off, okay? So if there are tall people in the room right there, if your limbs or your feet just extend beyond the bed, he'll cut you down to size. Now you may think, well, I'll be short then. If I'm short, I'm safe. But if you're shorter than the bed, he has a contraption that he would attach to your limbs that stretches your bones so that they fit the dimensions of the bed. This is what
Oh,
Procrustes did, right? So you must fit into the bed's image. You have to fit into the bed's image. And this is what was so violent about Procrustes. I've called that, I've written an essay where I make comparisons between Freud's couch and Procrustes' bed, right? And my idea is not to say, I'm not anti-psychiatry. I'm not anti-psychotherapy. I'm not even anti-psychoanalysis. psychoanalysis. But my point is to suggest that there's something about the image of the individual that modernity forces us to fit into. The image of the self that has agency, that has cognition, that has conation, right? We fit all these attributes. James Hillman was an archetypal psychologist, and he said that that the mind is in the psyche and not the other way around. The psyche is not in the mind. The mind is in the psyche. That's already a move of issue, right? The violence of the essential individual. This is what modernity enacts. So I don't think that my work right now is defined by the urgency of fixing the individual and putting that individual back into a society that is rapturously sick, and then receiving that individual again. There's a repetition that's going on here, right? It seems why do I focus on the individual that is an effect of a society that is sick? If my focus is on the individual, just a symptom of capitalist, extractivist, colonial, techno-bureaucratic relations in society, then I'm focusing on just a small aspect of what I should be focusing on. And I think this is where Jean-Henri comes in when he says the hospital is ill, the hospital is sick. And so I don't think that my work is about that anymore. I think my work, the proper focus of psychotherapeutic intervention, is society.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense for us in our context. I think most of us are also seekers in healing, in social work, in psychotherapy, and seek in a way that we are looking for ways that show us that a person is not only somebody who has to fit in a bed, but the bed is also in a world, and the sleep and the dreams and all our actions are really embedded in a world and in a living world. So this is what us, I think, moves on in our work. So to remind that the soul, because this was a Christian focus, no? That just the soul is in the body, and after the death, the soul, the individual soul, can make the journey to heaven. So this is a concept, no? Which also, how to say, which also brought the idea that the outer world is not with soul, is not with life, because we are the carrier of the brilliant life. I mean, it's also political. I mean, there you have a kind of political engagement.
May I add something to that? I think that the soul is sympoiesis. I used to think, growing up in Christian Nigeria, I used to think that the soul, because even now, we're a highly evangelical, Pentecostal, Christian arrangement. So I thought the soul was the ghost within the flesh. I no longer think that. I think of the soul as the leak, not the pipeline. It's the leakage. The soul is necessarily interspecies. The soul is becoming together. Like when an ant is infected by the fungus Ophiocordyceps unilateralis, and it goes away from its community. And it becomes this strange, monstrous thing that has no category, no taxonomy, and something starts to grow out from its head That's the soul. The soul is strange. It's not the domesticated mover of our limbs, right? Which is a very, very Enlightenment Euro-American concept. It's not the domesticated inside or interiority. The soul is when our borders, the boundaries of our skins, are interacting with ecology, right? It's how we're constantly co-making embodiment. Notice I didn't say bodies. Bodies are too individuated for me, right? They're too final. I think we are always in a process of individuation. This is a term that I'm using in the light of Gilbert Simondon's work, right? We're always in a process of becoming monstrous, becoming together, right? For instance, I often use this example. On your face, on your forehead, and on your cheeks, there's an entire community of little critters called Demodex. You can type it out. It's Demodex. They live deep in your skin pores. They are born there. They grow up there. They become teenagers there. They make love there. They get married there. They die there. They go to school there. They have land acknowledgement rights there. So the question then is,
They shit there.
what do you
They shit
They
there.
shit there. Thank you for not being polite, my sister. They shit there. And everything, they do everything in your face. So whose face is it? Whose face is it? Right? And this is where the trickster reminds us that you are not your own. You don't own yourself. You're not the owner of yourself. You're more foreign. You're more alien.
Maybe the systemic schools, they try a little bit to understand that we human beings, are living together with other human beings and doing some kind of social co-living. I mean, this is quite normal nowadays. But to open the mind that we're not only living together with human beings,
Yes.
with many, many, many other creatures and beings, yeah, this is something to make this kind of step. This is really a big, big, big change.
The way that I think about these things are largely encapsulated in what I call accommodation, which is a cousin to assemblage theory from Félix Guattari and Gilles Deleuze, right? Assemblage theory says there are no things. There are no things per se. Stop me if I glitch, okay, so that I get this across. There are no things, there are only relationships, right? And these relationships come together to produce things, right? And those things are not things in a final way. They are also dense relationships that come together for a while. So, to put it in a different way, as Karen Barad, my dear friend and researcher in quantum physics, would say, and professor in consciousness and physics and feminist studies, would say that relationships precede the things that relate. I'll say it again. Relationships precede the things that relate, right? Before the I claims exclusivity, there is a world that had to happen, right? There is a world of relationships and ongoing negotiations. So when you see the world as a web, that is constantly a web of heterogeneous aspects that is constantly interacting with each other, then you get a sense that we are in a much more complex place than modernity knows how to think about. A good example of this would be AI. We thought that we th this is my I have a theory called cybermarronage, and I won't go into the deep parts. Cyber from cyborg, and marronage from the act of escaping design, right? Right. The act of escaping the plantation is marronage, right? It's also the way that I think about the phenomenon of AI is the way that I say, for instance, that we did not invent AI. And that might be controversial because we obviously did. Of course, if we didn't do that, then who did? But I have a sense that we've been traveling with other forms of intelligences for a long time. And they're showing up now as what we rudely call AI. Let me say something more about that. Scientists are discovering, researchers are discovering that we're now speaking like AI more. I don't know if you noticed this. Let me first ask another question. I'm sure I'll get more hands this time. How many of you use ChatGPT? Just raise up your hands. There you go. Finally, you're in the room. Here's what researchers are noticing. We don't just use ChatGPT. ChatGPT uses us, right? They're sympoesis. There are sympoetic relations happening. Researchers are now beginning to discover that we're speaking like ChatGPT. We're speaking the cadence, the use of I forget what that grammatical instance is, that grammatical example, the way that ChatGPT speaks, it says something like it uses comparison to make its emphatic comments or sentences even more powerful. It says, not only this, but this. It does this all the time. It says, I had a great time at the Sympoetic Institute yesterday. Not only great, but emphatic. It does this all the time. It does that. Well, in English, I don't know how it shows up in languages, but the thing is, we're using that now, and it mimics the ways that we have been that we're constantly being used by the tools that we think we use, right? For instance, in the 70s, in the 1970s, cognitive psychologists needed a model of the mind, of memory, how the mind works, and what did they turn to? They turned to computers. It was how computers were starting to come into the world at that time. And so they started to study computers. And it's from our study of computers that we developed the language memorization, forgetting, short-term memory, long-term memory, storage, recovery. All this came from learning from computers. Think about that for a moment. If we learn from the things that we create in order to understand the creator, then where is the creator? Right? How do we trace the beginning of the creator if we had to look at the created to understand the creator? Right? It's like Freud. I'm not a fan of Freud, but Freud said it the best. The child is the father of the man. Right? So the idea of a stable, independent, sovereign, majestic creator who just designs the world into being is broken by sympoesis. Because with sympoesis, there is no starting point. There is no origin, right? It's somewhere in the middle. We will draw the lines and say this is where the origin is, but how do we know? How do we know? It's a political move. We draw the line and say this is where the origin is, right? So this is how I see the world. It's we are using cars, but cars are using us as well. It's a co-making process, you see. Modernity starts by looking at the individual that makes the world and totally forgets that the world makes the individual in return.
I think the tricksters are laughing a lot about us. They love these moments. you have this picture of the ant mill, and what you told us now reminds me of this image.
Right.
We are going in the circle, in the circle, in the circle, and we can't find out.
Yes.
What are your ideas, how to come out,
Yes.
how to make new things, how to remember what we have already known long time ago?
Yes.
There again, the Yoruba wisdom or other wisdoms in the world from older times. What are your concepts, your ideas?
So, yeah, in that story of the ant stuck in a pheromonic accident, going around in circles, unable to stop, I'm seeking to describe modern arrangements, notions of choreography, where we presuppose that leadership will get us out of our rut. Leadership will get us out of fascism. Leadership will get us out of climate chaos. Leadership will save the day, right? But what if leadership is a form of, is a trap, the way we think about leadership? What if leadership is the way we think about leadership is a trap that just keeps us going around in a circle? So I think about po politics and leadership and agency in very, very, let's say, trickstery ways. I don't think about the soul as that which is domesticated within the body, like I've said. I think of the soul as the interspecies moment when the body is becoming something else entirely that doesn't have taxonomy or classification. I don't think about leadership as someone who has all the skills to move others. I think of that as management, actually. That organizations don't do leadership, they do management, right? I mean, in leadership discourse, I think you might say that there are two questions. Where does leadership come from? One part of this argument says leadership comes from capacity that you cultivate. So you're not born with leadership, you cultivate the capacity to lead others. And leading means inspiring others in a direction. Another part of this conversation says, no, you're born with leadership. Some people just have it, like Obama has it, and Trump doesn't, or maybe he does, right? Like it's the way we think about leadership as genetic, as embodied in the individual. I think none of them are holding weight in the way that I hope that they would. I think that leadership is the leakage. When you think about a murmuration of birds, no one is actually leading. You know what I mean by murmuration? The murmuration of starlings in the sky and the wonderful shapes that they make, right? How did they do this choreography, this movement? It's been studied. I don't know that there is any definitive answer to that, but I'm studying leadership and agency and accountability and the soul as a stranger thing than we can accommodate. So when you ask me, what do I propose? What I propose is what I call parapolitics. Okay. And by parapolitics, I'm speaking about all the things that politics cannot hold. Politics is the realm of social actors making decisions to move the world. I'm vastly more interested in how the world moves us. And I think that if we had space for that, if we had space to sit with the sympoetic densities, the thresholds, the ways that cracks show up in the world, right? If we had ways to study how souls travel, then we might be alive to different sensations, different ways of thinking, different ways of feeling and being in the world. And that, I think, disrupts the circle, the trap of the death spiral. So what I propose, which I cannot speak about in 10 minutes, I've been speaking about it for years now. It'll take one more year to get through articulating just what parapolitics means. I propose that we hold space for a seductive, fugitive kind of politics that mimics what Eshu did when he left the shores of Africa and decided to join the slave ship, to infiltrate the slave ship from within and become a sympoetic archetype of the future.
I mean, I see there in your screen dancing with mountains. So
Yes.
maybe this is another language you call
Yes.
parapolitics.
Indeed, I like
Yeah.
that. Dancing with mountains is another name for parapolitics. Yes. Because mountains are not still. They're pretending to be still and stationary. They're actually dancing really hard. And we just need to know how
Yeah.
to dance with them. Yeah.
Yeah, so we had 1 hour together. I don't know if you have some minutes left, so that,
Yes. Yes.
yeah, I don't know, because there is no leadership though, so then we are organizing ourselves
No.
also spontaneously. Maybe there is something somebody of you want to ask, want to feedback, want to share.
I wonder what creates these cracks.
He wonders what creates the cracks.
Oh, that's a beautiful question. That is a beautiful question. In a nutshell, it's the void that creates cracks. The cracks are negotiations between form and becoming. If I had time, I would take you through my theory of ontal amnesia. I will probably speak about Professor Florian Newcart's notion of quantum memory matrix. I would speak about blackness and the imminent void. I will speak about difference, but what I would say for now is that our bodies are constantly negotiating with becoming. It looks like they're still and stationary, but they're not, right? Right now, you are bleeding skin cells and cells from your body. Millions and millions of cells are dissipating. You are fading away and you're becoming something else, right? Cracks are how reality keeps itself fresh, right? Fascism is the attempt to nullify, pathologize, flatten, smoothen out the creases of cracks. And that's why we need a politics that knows how to pay attention to cracks. So, what creates the cracks? Not human beings, but the very structure, the moving dynamic structure of space-time itself.
We are always flooded in a way by molecules,
Yes.
virus, these things here. Maybe let me bring in this word. And we are also flooded with ancestral movements.
Yes, we are. We're flooded by ancestrality. We think we're well put together. We are flooded by algorithms, by policies. All these things, the modernity looks at the selfie. It creates images, stable images. It says, reflect on yourself. Look in the river and reflect on yourself, right? But as the story of Narcissus, the story of Narcissus, Greek mythology, teaches us, even reflection isn't safe. When you look at yourself, you slowly become a flower. That is a crack. There's a crack in everything. And no, I don't mean to say there's a crack in everything and that's how the light gets in, Leonard Cohen. No, I don't think the crack is where the light gets in. I think the crack is where light gains new meaning or a different meaning. A crack is not just a hole or a portal. It's not just an entry point. A crack is the argument that reality is having with the form that you've taken.
To terms you're using very often. One is to grieve, and the other is to carnival. You use both as verbs.
Yes.
I think the trickster knows very much about to carnival. I
Yes.
think he's not interested in grieving, but could you tell us more about these terms which are very important for you?
Yes. So I think grieving and carnivaling are of the same ethical universe, actually. There's something about grieving that resists the domination of story. It's when our bodies want to do something that our stories do not allow for. I'm recalling right now the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, the DSM, right? The DSM-5, the Clinical Psychologist's Bible. In the psychologist's Bible, grief is pathology. If you grieve for a certain period of time, there's something wrong with you. I think it's for a year or so. If you grieve for a year continuously, then there's something wrong with you. But there's something about grief that reminds me of that phrase from St. Paul in I forget which part of the Christian text it is, but he calls it the thorn in the flesh. A thorn in the flesh. And I don't know if anyone knows that phrase. The thorn in the flesh was what Paul constantly asked God to remove. But God responded by saying, "My grace is sufficient for you. Stay with a thorn." Grief is a thorn, and carnival is a thorn as well. It's just a reminder that our bodies are not still, right? Historically, the carnival was this. I mean, it came from the church, but the church co-opted it from pagan traditions. Pagan traditions. And there's something about it that resists the co-opting of the body. It says the body is doing more dynamic than the images we have of it. So how do we celebrate the body in its movement? Grief is a form of celebration, in my opinion. Grief is carnival, actually, I would say. The two are doing beautiful things that breaks apart the idea of the stable body.
Are there some more questions here in the room?
Can you hear me like this?
I can hear you. How are you doing?
You said in the beginning that when we try to heal an individuum and put it in the society, which is actually sick,
Yes.
we should better try to fix maybe the society, or I don't know, maybe the relationship. What would be a step you would propose to more healthy?
I'm not, for instance, saying that you ought not to have therapy, or you ought not to visit your psychotherapist, or you ought not to have a to-do list. I'm not saying any of that. I'm just noticing the larger patterns here, right? The pattern of how our healing traditions focus almost exclusively on the well-being of the individual without noticing that these dynamics of pathology emerge from social arrangements. For instance, do you know of the diagnostic category called, it's old now, it doesn't exist anymore, called drapetomania. Does anyone here know drapetomania? Drapetomania was invented by another dude that I cannot remember his name right now. I'm doing very poorly tonight. But drapetomania came in the antebellum South in the United States, right? It was named for those slaves in the plantation that had feelings of freedom. That is to say, if you wanted to be free from the plantation, there was something wrong with you. And that was an official category, right? So that it kept
Diagnosis,
people,
huh?
It was diagnosis that if you're thinking, I'm really not enjoying this slavery thing. I feel like being free. You are sick. So it's not like there are stable steps. There are already established steps for how to shift from the individual to society. They're not stable categories. It's not a question of I've been focusing on individual all this time. Now it's time to look at society. No, it's a political thing. And the invitation is to notice, sister, that we are undergoing subtle shifts where the individual itself is unable to bear the weight of therapy. Right? And this is the subtle move that we are so well these days. That we're bored of being well. We're tired of being well, right? Wellness is now a billion euros industry. We have wellness apps, wellness traditions, wellness lists, wellness resistance cultures. We have language around wellness. We have wellness algorithms. We measure everything. We measure how many steps we're taking, how many breaths we're taking, how much sweat is coming out of our body. Wellness is so overwhelming that the individual cannot hold the weight of our wellness any longer. That is already a sign. That is already a sign that the way we've crafted wellness is political, is historical, is racializing, it's tired. And so I sense that new practices will emerge, and they will emerge slowly through art. Through exhaustion, through all these subtle forms of resistance, new artistic practices in therapeutic intervention will emerge that do not focus exclusively on the individual. And they're already there, right? In indigenous traditions, there isn't a focus on individuals. The Yoruba people, if you came to a Yoruba healer and you said, "So I have this problem, and I have this problem, and I have this problem, what's your solution?" The healer will look away from you, will literally look away from you as if to acknowledge all the ancestors that are in the room. Because to them, it's not about you. It's about larger weather patterns, larger arrangements in the field. And so I think these will slowly come to light. Don't fret if you don't have it all together. It's not a solution. This is not a solution. It's a gradual emergence.
So maybe this is a good moment to remember your conversation with the Yoruba elders, the Yoruba healers, many years ago.
Yes.
What did they say? What was your conversation about?
Well, it was about a lot of things. I was still a very thoroughbred clinical psychologist. I had a master's degree. I was teaching in the university. I was now doing my PhD, and I wanted to. The Nigerian government was undergoing a crisis. It was a psychiatric crisis. It was a crisis in the care industry, right? We didn't have enough bed spaces to accommodate people who were suffering, and so the question that people were asking was, okay, how do we respond to this crisis? And then I was already starting to notice that maybe the way we respond to the crisis is part of the crisis. What if it's not about building new hospitals? What if there was something more, something we're missing? So I went to study these individuals and their practices in order to proliferate care practices. I wanted to say that there are other ways we can practice care that we're not noticing because we're colonized. And so I went to them, and my aim was to see parallels between Western psychotherapeutic practices and their practices. And I thought I could establish some kind of correspondence with between as other Afrocentric clinical thinkers had done in the past. But that failed beautifully, and it's the very basis of my public intellectual career. Because I would ask them a question. I would say, "What do you call What do you call auditory hallucination in your world? How do you practice healing people hearing voices in their head? And the man would lean forward and say, "Why would I want to heal that? What if that's a gift? What if that's your grandmother speaking to you?" They were speaking from an entirely different spiritual tradition that did not see these pathologies as pathological. They saw it as a spiritual crisis, a call for ceremony, a call for ritual, a call for sitting together, a call for food, right? They saw it instead of as something to medicate, they saw it as a tool of emergence. And that shook me up. And I have many more examples, but basically the idea was that I left those interviews forever changed. I thought that I could just establish a simple correspondence between my traditions and Western traditions, but they taught me that there are other worlds altogether. There are other ways of being alive. And you're missing out on that because you're too involved with healing. And healing is political.
Thank you very much. I mean, we could stay with you, I think, quite a long time.
Thank you. Thank you.
We could share and learn a lot together.
I would like that. Let's do that. Let's arrange for that. Let's conspire.
Thank you
Yeah.
very much.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. Bye, people.
Das war's für heute. Wir danken euch fürs Zuhören und freuen uns natürlich über Nachrichten, Rückmeldungen, Fragen, Geschichten. Wenn ihr euch weiter mit der Arbeit von Bioakkumulafe beschäftigen wollt, findet ihr Links zu seinen Websites und Hinweise auf Bücher in den Shownotes. Alles Gute für euch. Ciao.